Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
They are so far away, but might hit so close to home. The Hong Kong protests and the global economy on the broadcast today. Also, why finding love in Silicon Valley is surprisingly low tech. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the studios of Houston Public Media in, yes, Houston, Texas, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Monday, everybody. It is the 29th of September today. On the other side of the international dateline, though, it is already Tuesday. What many in Hong Kong are expecting to be another day of protests in the heart of that very capitalist city. The demonstrations do have political roots. Demands for the central Chinese government in Beijing to allow free elections in Hong Kong. But they may well have distinctly economic after effects. Kate Davidson gets us going.
Jeff Wasserstrom studies protest movements in China. He says the demonstrators filling the streets of Hong Kong don't want Beijing to vet their political candidates. They want Hong Kong to remain different from the mainland.
There are things you can talk about. There are books you can buy in Hong Kong, even though it's part of the People's Republic of China, that are off limits in other parts of the People's Republic of China.
And those differences extend to the financial sector. Hong Kong has freer capital flows, more financial regulations, and the rule of law, all very attractive for businesses. Nariman Baravish is chief economist of IHS.
You've got a lot of Western banks having big operations there. You've got a lot of Chinese banks. So Hong Kong plays a very important role financially in Asia, but especially with respect to financial flows and capital flows in and out of China.
Hong Kong is often called a gateway to China. So an American or European manufacturer typically might set up a plant in mainland China to lower labor costs, but it would also have a presence in Hong Kong, where it's easier to raise capital in the Asian markets. Economist Hei Wai Tang is from Hong Kong and teaches at Johns Hopkins.
So they would try to do most of the financial services and transactions in Hong Kong and do the manufacturing or selling inside China.
The democracy protests in Hong Kong might cause short-term market disruptions. But Tang says the big question Western businesses have to grapple with is what Hong Kong's integration with China looks like if China's in charge. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
You could make a case that advertisers are in charge at Facebook. The company needs them to help make money off all that data we all so willingly provide. And along those lines, Facebook is rolling out a new advertising tool today that it claims will be a real game changer. It wants to merge data from its more than 1 billion active monthly users with information from their travels across the internet on computers and mobile phones alike, with the end result being that advertisers would then be able to buy ads outside of Facebook. Complicated, I know. Here's Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson to explain.
There's historically been this black hole between people's internet use on smartphones and computers. Nate Elliott is an analyst at Forrester Research.
So you can target people who like the New York Yankees on the PC. You can target people who like the New York Yankees on a phone, but you're never quite sure today if you're catching the same people on both of those platforms.
Facebook's Atlas service wants to close that gap and let advertisers better measure whether their ads worked. But Elliott cautions that Facebook is short on details about how they'll do this. If the service is as good as the company claims, Karen North, a professor of digital social media at USC's Annenberg School, says it could help Facebook better compete in its ad wars with Google.
I believe where Facebook has struggled in the past is that people don't go to Facebook to buy things. And so now they're deciding, well, maybe the whole Facebook ad idea isn't the right answer. Maybe it's, we'll just be the place to come to buy ads.
A couple of years ago, Facebook watchers were bemoaning its lack of a mobile strategy. So this is fast progress, says Roger Kay, president of Endpoint Technologies Associates. But it may elevate the privacy concerns many users already have with Facebook.
I would say that if it's done well, you will notice it. Because what you'll find is the creepy effect, that you'll visit a site and then you'll go somewhere else and notice an ad for something that seems to be related to that site you just visited.
Facebook says it won't give advertisers identifying information about users. Just lots and lots of data. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Facebook shares rose today in what could have really been a lousy session at the corner of Wall Street and Broad. As it turns out, not too bad at all. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The much-decorated AMC series Breaking Bad aired its very last episode a year ago today. That show, as its millions and millions and millions of fans know, was set in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and although the curtain has come down on Walter White and the gang, the city is still reaping the benefits. Richard Berry is the mayor of Albuquerque. Mr. Mayor, it's good to have you with us.
Hey, it's great to be with you today. Thank you.
You know, if you read a lot of stories about this program, one of the things all the actors say and the showrunner Vince Gilligan, they all say Albuquerque became a character in this program. How do you think that happened?
Well, it's a beautiful place. You know, Albuquerque is a very diverse place, both from a demographic standpoint, but also from a geographic standpoint. We've got, you know, mountains, rivers, high desert. Breaking Bad success, I think that was really an over-the-top thing for us in a good way, because it really put us on the map as a place where extremely well-crafted art could be made. And of course, we've had a lot of great films made here over the years, but none better than Breaking Bad.
Do you see tourism coming? I mean, you know, JetBlue has flights down. American Airlines have direct flights to Albuquerque. Are you seeing people come because of this show?
We do. We actually see people that will come here specifically to go to see the sights. We have a young man named Jesse that runs some trolley tours here. He's a former city employee who now has a trolley that takes people around on tours, and that trolley is full every time I see it. So I've been as far as Beijing where people have asked me about Breaking Bad. So, yeah, it really has put us on the map internationally.
Here comes the flip side, though. I mean, production was over plus or minus a year ago. Any slowdown that you're feeling?
No, actually, it's I don't know what the phenomenon is, but because it's in syndication it's still on television, people are still very actively involved in the program. A lot of people tell us that they're just now getting through the entire series. So my in-laws, for example, are on, I think, season three. And so there's a lot of people trying to catch up with the program, and that's good news for us. And I think it will survive. Certainly it will survive in the world of theory for a long time. People will be studying Breaking Bad and what Vince Gilligan did. But I think that we've got many years ahead of us of it still being an iconic program.
How much are you banking on, what's the name of the spinoff, Better Call Saul?
Well, I went to buy a tie at one of my local haberdasheries the other day, and they were closed because they were filming Better Call Saul. So, and the guy was Bert and Jess is the name of the place here in Albuquerque, and they were very pleased to have the program there. So, I think it's the same scenario when Breaking Bad filmed here, 68 episodes, $1 million per direct spend, so almost $70 million that came into our economy, and that's not just, you know, above the line folks. That's not just actors. That is electricians, and it's the lumberyard selling lumber, and it is craft, and it is the local places that rent their businesses out to film. It really hits our economy from top to bottom. So we think that Better Call Saul is going to be another great opportunity for us.
You know, I had a conversation with the mayor of Nashville, Tennessee, when that show first came out.
Mayor Dean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he basically said, you know, it's great, and we're happy for all the attention and the economic boost, but it's nice when they go on hiatus and we get our city back a little bit.
I don't think we feel that way at all. We'll roll out the red carpet any day. When film comes here and they need to close down a street or we need to do whatever we need to do to facilitate that, it just happens with a, you know, snap of a finger, quite frankly, and we'll just work hard to keep it that way.
Yeah, but your motorcade probably doesn't get redirected, does it?
I drove myself to work this morning, so I don't really have an entourage. But if I had a motorcade, maybe that's a good idea. Maybe I should get a motorcade.
That's
now.
That's right. Mayor Richard Berry in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Mr. Mayor, thanks very much for your time.
Hey, thanks for highlighting this great program in our city.
One in three people in this country who have married recently met their partners online. Online dating is a billion-dollar industry. Whether it's websites or apps, sometimes the computer really does know best. But you know what? Algorithms aren't necessarily for everyone, even those in that center of the high-tech universe, Silicon Valley. So some have turned to the good old-fashioned kind of matchmaking. Shannon Service has that story.
All right, my room is an awful mess.
Michael Ralston is walking me through his bachelor pad. We're heading to his closet so he can show me the stylish new shirts he wears on dates.
I like all three of these, and they're just, you know, button-downs with a little bit of pattern and color.
Ralston's a Silicon Valley software designer, and a year ago, his wardrobe was jeans and t-shirts. Then came Amy Anderson of Lynx Dating. She set Ralston up with a nice haircut, mock dates, an emergency wardrobe adjustment.
Dinner reservations and recommendations, sedan bookings should they not want to drive for the date.
Anderson lists some of Lynx's many services.
Shopping for some proper hand towels, making sure the refrigerator is stocked with some decent wine.
Think Fiddler on the Roof meets My Fair Lady, but with a lot more money. Anderson carves out the higher end of the dating market, charging up to $100,000 to make over and match her Silicon Valley clients. She hit on the idea one night when her date kept looking over her shoulder.
And so I called him on it and I said, "What are you doing?" And he literally said, "The BBD." And I said, "The what a, huh? The bigger, better deal."
The bigger, better deal is a Silicon Valley anxiety disorder where you can't stop searching for the next hot startup. Anderson realized that the sheer number of singles online creates a kind of dating BBD.
The grass is always greener. There has to be somebody else that's just a little bit more interesting or a little bit of a better match.
A third of Americans also think online dating's masses make it hard to pick just one. But if you do win the electronic love lottery, studies show online couples have higher satisfaction and lower divorce rates. So Lynx offers a blend, a large enough pool to find deep matches, but not so many that clients get stuck in choice paralysis.
Exhale.
So she works with Ralston on the basics, learning to breathe deeply and relax. She and Ralston go over the dreaded pre-date phone call.
Ring.
Hello.
Hello, Amy. This is Michael. Amy from Lynx gave me your number.
Oh, hi. How are you, Michael?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. How was your work day?
Pretty good. So,
Tell me about it. What were you feeling right then when I just said, you know, how was your day? Tell me about it.
It's like, oh, no.
They practice the call several times until Ralston is able to go off script and be more spontaneous. So life lessons, wardrobe makeovers, mock dates, all this costs Ralston over 10 grand. But does he think it's worth the price?
I've always been socially awkward, and I think I'm less so now. I mean, and from one point of view, the answer to that question is it going to work?
High-end matchmakers say they successfully pair 80 to 90% of their clients. But what successful match means is harder to pin down. In Silicon Valley, I'm Shannon Service for Marketplace.
Coming up,
science is doing lots of stuff that may or may not have anything to do with us.
What exactly is that an ad for anyway? Anyone? Anyone? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 41 points today, about 0.25%, ended at 17,071. The NASDAQ slipped 6 points, 0.1%, finished at 4505. The S&P 500 dropped itself 5 points lower, about 0.25%, closed at 1977. Every week, new data suggests the housing market is still struggling. Today, the number of existing homes under contract, as in the neighbor's house with a sale pending sign on the front lawn, that number fell last month. One reason, apparently, the share of homes bought as investments rather than, you know, homes, fell to 12% from 16%. Sounds insignificant, but oh, it matters. Shares of RealG, which owns Coldwell Banker, were off 2%. Zillow, the home of Zestimates, also fell 2%. Today, Trulia, another online real estate site, slid 2.6% lower. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.48%. That, by the way, is called a flight to quality. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. The Oakland Athletics play the Kansas City Royals in Major League Baseball's first postseason game. And long before How to Get Away with Murder, there was Murder, She Wrote. It premiered 30 years ago. There was enough murder for 12 seasons. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace Today from Houston Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Who exactly can get their hands on our phone data has been a topic of much, much controversy the past couple of years. That tension has now extended to the world of federal contracting, specifically which company will be chosen to route our phone calls, direct them from place to place, as it were. The New York Times reports today that the contract for that service might be taken from an American company, Neustar by name, and awarded to one that is foreign-owned. Marketplace's Queenie Kim has the rest of that story.
We take it for granted, but once upon a time, if you switched phone carriers, you had to switch your telephone number. Then in 1997, Congress said you can keep your number even if you switch.
And so that resulted in a great deal of confusion.
Ahmed Kapoor is a professor at UC Hastings Law School. He says that's because before that law, each phone service provider was awarded blocks of numbers. If police wanted to tap a number, they would know which company to go to. But once you could keep your number, that system was gone. So the feds contracted with a company named Neustar to keep track of all the phone numbers. Also, every time you make a call, it's Neustar that routes your call to the right carrier.
Is essentially a central pathway for all calls to and from telephone lines that utilize U.S. telecom services.
Now, Neustar might lose that contract to Ericsson, which is based in Sweden. Neustar says this would be bad for national security. Jonathan Mayer is a fellow at Stanford's Center for International Security and Cooperation.
It certainly is a legitimate concern that the company that routes phone calls is in a position to know a fair amount about law enforcement and intelligence investigation.
Mayer says, for example, a hostile country could break in and see that law enforcement is asking about the phone numbers of its spies. Christopher Segoyan is a technologist at the ACLU, and he says an American-based company can't protect data any better than one based in Europe.
The security community doesn't know how to build a system that allows access to one party but keeps others out.
Segoyan says the only way to keep data out of the hands of the bad guys is to secure it from everybody, even law enforcement. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
The Supreme Court in the state of Ohio ruled earlier this month that it could conceivably be all right to strip mine in state wildlife areas. Turns out that when Ohio bought the land in question in this case back in 1944, it didn't get what are called mineral rights, the rights to the stuff that is underground, coal, oil, and gas in particular. And in certain cases, mineral rights owners can do whatever it takes to get their hands on the stuff that they own. So as the fracking boom spreads, a lot of homeowners who don't own their mineral rights are learning that lesson the hard way. Marketplace's Dan Weissman reports.
Jim O'Reilly teaches law and public health at the University of Cincinnati. He's writing a legal textbook about fracking. Here's how he describes the conflict between surface rights owners and mineral rights. Say the two of us own a house with a beautiful lawn, but not the mineral rights.
Someone else can buy the coal or the oil or the gas underneath us and then say, I've got a right to put up this massive drilling rig and do all this other stuff, and you're screwed.
It's become a big enough issue in some parts of Ohio, parts with a lot of coal and oil, that real estate listings now often specify whether mineral rights are included in the deed. Other places, not so much yet, which leads to unpleasant surprises. But when someone buys a house, isn't this what the title search company is getting paid to do? Lance Estrella is a lawyer who specializes in mineral rights issues. He says, nope.
Most title companies do not insure minerals, so to be certain who owns the minerals on your property, you have to check the county records generally.
Which is a big undertaking. There's a mitigating factor. Lawyers call it the doctrine of accommodation. The mineral owner is supposed to make accommodations to the surface owner, but state laws vary a lot. Judon Fambro is an attorney with the Real Estate Center at Texas A&M University. And in his state,
the accommodation doctrine said, is there a way to accommodate the surface owner? And this is what they forget to mention, and at the same time produce the oil and gas. It's not accommodation strictly.
It's more like, hey, if there's a win-win here, great. Otherwise,
you're in a mell of a hiss, yeah.
In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
From minerals in general to specific elements now, our every now and then contributor Justin Rowlett from the BBC has been doing a series that is a slightly different way of looking at the global economy. It's called Elemental Business, about the chemical elements and how they affect the business cycle. Today, we go to the upper right corner of the periodic table, symbol SI, atomic number 14, silicon. Justin, good to talk to you again.
Very good to talk to you, Kai.
Okay, I'm going to get this question out of the way right up front. Silicon or silicone?
Well, we would say silicon. I'm guessing you're going to tell me it's silicone.
No, I'm going to say silicon.
Good. Well, let's go with silicon.
Okay. All right. So what is it? What is it used for? And there is actually a thing called silicone, too, isn't there?
Silicon is a metallic element. It's not actually a metal, but it's a metallic element. It is extraordinarily common. 3/4 of the Earth's crust is made of silica. But, incredibly common element.
Am I oversimplifying if I say that silicon is basically really, really, really purified sand?
Essentially, that's exactly right. Yeah, sand has a high silica content. That silica is silicon dioxide. You need to get rid of those two oxygens to create pure elemental silicon, and then you refine it. So it has to be incredibly pure.
Other than silicon chips, from whence Silicon Valley comes and all that, what is it used for?
Silicon is the basis of glass. 5,000 years ago, man discovered how to actually make glass. And frankly, well, we haven't looked back since then. We've been looking through glass ever since. Glass is one of those absolutely essential technologies we completely take for granted. So in a sense, you know, we think of the Silicon Revolution being computers. Actually, probably the first, one of the very, very early technological revolutions was glass. And arguably, it's at least as important as all the computers that we use.
There is also a sustainability part of this substance as well, right? It's used in solar panels and solar
manufacturing. There is. And this, I was going to argue, was the third potential kind of silicon-based revolution. The fact that it's a semiconductor also makes it very useful for solar panels. The light kind of, what it was described to me, the light sort of knocks the electrons out and therefore allows it to create a circuit. Mm. I mean, that's a sort of grossly simplified description of how it works, but essentially that's what happens. As they've developed the solar technology, we've seen a very rapid fall in the price of solar. The argument is that the price of solar panels will halve every time the amount of installed solar panels doubles. Sounds a bit obscure, but what it means is over the last 30 years, prices have gone from about $100 a watt to less than $1 a watt. And it's also an incredible technology because it's so portable. You know, you don't need the kind of electricity grid that we have at the moment. So that means it's a technology that can be exported in the same way that, for example, mobile telephones transformed the economy of many developing countries. Solar's doing the same. You know, you can have a kind of literally a mud hut in the desert. You can put a solar panel on the top and they can be watching, I don't know, NBA basketball.
Justin Rowlett, his series for the BBC is called Elemental Economics. Justin, thanks a bunch.
Cheers. Thanks, Kai.
It's the ad that comes before the online video you're trying to watch, or the ad on the actual TV, a hopeful message from a company trying to sell you on them, usually with no shortage of inspirational imagery and plenty of metaphors. Here's Kendra Esch, adapted from her essay in McSweeney's.
This is a generic brand video. Science is doing lots of stuff that may or may not have anything to do with us. See how this guy in a lab coat holds up a beaker? That means we do research. Also, we care about the environment, loosely. Here's some powerful, rushing water and people planting trees. In today's high-speed environment, stop-motion footage of a city at night with cars turning quickly makes you think about doing things efficiently and time passing. Lest you think we're a faceless entity, look at all these attractive people. Here's some of them talking and laughing. Equality, innovation, honesty, and advancement are all words we chose from a list. Here's a picture of DNA. See how we're part of the global economy? Look at these farmers in China. But we also do business in the USA, or want you to think we do. Using a specific ratio of Asian people to black people to women to white men, we want to make sure we represent your needs and interests, or at least a version of your skin color in our ads. Check out this wind energy thing in Indiana, and this blue-collar guy with dirt on his face. Did we put a baby in here? What about an ethnic old man whose wrinkled smile represents the happiness and wisdom of the poor? Yep, we did.
That was Kendra Ash. Her essay, This is a Generic Brand Video, was originally published in McSweeney's. We have the link, as we always do, on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today found in the pages of the New York Times this morning, and which is, when you stop to think about it, a thing of pure, pure genius. Scientists in Thailand are set to unveil a robot that will be able to tell whether Thai food is actually genuine Thai food. Proper proportions, the right taste, good texture, you get the idea. The possibilities, honestly, are endless. Think about it, testing Mexican food, Chinese, Indian to boot. Of course, it's entirely possible we Americans have just come to prefer fake ethnic food, because I'm here to tell you, Chinese food here and Chinese food there, once in Buyan, completely not the same thing. All right, that's it. We got to go. Today, the Dow off 41 points, the NASDAQ down 6, the S&P 500 lost 5 points. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, and Daisy Palacios. Thanks today to the staff here at Houston Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.